You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of June 2016 on Monaco 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's show:
many of the British ideas about the EU are gaining support all over Europe. There are so many things we can do together. Living now doesn't make any sense.
European Council President Donald Tusk there. With only days left before a crucial referendum, Brexit continues to dominate headlines across Europe. Will Britain remain or leave the European Union? I'll discuss the latest with my guests Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion. Plus, football violence in France, the latest from Orlando, and why a massive cyber attack might trigger a military response from NATO. That is all to come on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. So we have a busy program ahead. My guests today are Michael Binion, who is Foreign Affairs Specialist at The Times, and Sebastian Borger, who is Berliner Zeitung's London correspondent. Now, two more polls released today confirm that currently more Britons seem to want to leave the European Union than want to stay in. According to an Ipsos Mori phone poll, 53% of Britons would vote to leave, compared to 47% who want to remain in the bloc. According to another poll by Servation, the percentage of Britons who would vote to leave the EU has risen 7 points last month to 45%, and 42% would vote to remain. There is only 1 week left to go until the June 23rd referendum. Michael, if I start with you first, what do you think? What has happened in the recent weeks? It wasn't that long time ago when the Remain camp was in the lead. Have they just simply not managed to come up with good enough and convincing enough arguments?
Well, they've not come up with a positive vision of why we should stay in Europe and what Europe can offer Britain. They've come up with threats about what would happen to the economy if it all goes wrong, and that's gone down very badly because people don't like being threatened. And I'm afraid it looks as though, to many people, it's the kind of the toffs, the ruling class, who are protecting their own interests. But at the same time, I think a much more important change is that the Leave campaign has seized on immigration as the key issue. They've told what I think are complete load of lies about immigration, but they're very effective lies. In other words, they've said that if we leave the European Union, straight away we will be able to start controlling who comes and in what numbers they come to Britain. And this is clearly the most important issue for a great many people in this country.
Sebastian, I guess you are one of those migrants. I am as well. How are you seeing the situation? What do you think? What would be the best argument from the Remain camp now to fight against?
It's very late in the day, you know. I mean, the problem, of course, is that the campaign is led by a Prime Minister, David Cameron, who promised before the election but last to bring down migration from the European Union to the tens of thousands. And of course, it's somewhere near 180,000 when last we looked. All in all, net migration was 330,000. So the figures are very awkward for him. Even though, and that's something which I don't hear said enough in the campaign, half of those 330,000 are students who actually bring in money into the country. You know, the tertiary education sector is a great money spinner for this country, apart from, of course, spreading Britain's soft power, because these people, some of them will stay and take good jobs, others will go home and hopefully with a good experience. It is, as Michael says, the Remain campaign has totally failed in making a positive case for the European Union, for Britain's place in the European Union, and also you can make a good case for migration. It's a successful country that people want to move to. It's failed countries like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, where people want to move away from. I mean, you know, you've got to make the case. They don't make the case.
How much do facts matter at this stage?
Not very much, unfortunately, because every fact is disputable. Every statistic can be turned this way or that. They're very hard to verify. It depends where you take them from, in what context you put the statistics. It's sometimes, I'm afraid, quite blatant that people say things that are a great exaggeration, such as, for example, saying that this country pays the European Union £350 million, or is it billion? I don't know.
Million.
It doesn't really
million.
Matter. Hardly
Goodness,
matters.
No, you couldn't pay billions.
Every year.
And no, every week. 350 million per week.
There you are. You see, I'm not even sure what the figure is. But what is wrong is that they're not even starting to say how much we get back in regional aid.
No, but I disagree with Michael on this point. I think typically the Remain campaign always talks about we pay much less. Well, that's... But what the point the leavers make is we're paying money. And what the government should say is, yes, it's an important organization. We are a rich country. Britain is a rich country. We are paying towards an organization which helps our most important export market to develop. You know, that's the whole principle of the European Union. They don't do it. They don't do it.
And looking at this, as Michael said, it's quite hard for the Remain camp to create a positive case to stay in the European Union. At the same time, the Leave campaign, well, they can't quite guarantee things either, because no one seems to know what really is going to happen if the UK leaves the European Union. Is it simply that we see the Remain camp now just trying to respond somehow to what's the Leave camp
Yes,
start
I'm afraid they've been put on the back foot. And the other problem is that although I believe that the European Union is a great and idealistic and magnificent achievement which has brought peace and stability to Europe for many years, a lot of young people take that entirely for granted. They don't know what the post-war situation was at all. It's all old history and old memories. And the other thing is that there's no way in which the present campaign can be kind of given some energy and some buzz when all the government ministers are saying we need to reform the European Union.
European politicians have remained relatively quiet about this topic. Well, in the beginning of this programme, we heard from European Council President Donald Tusk. He was warning earlier today that economic and political consequences of Britain leaving the EU would be dangerous for both the UK and the rest of Europe. Michael, if I ask from you, you being from here, how do you think this kind of statements by European politicians are going to be received in the UK? Are they going to have a positive effect?
I'm afraid they won't. I wish they did, but I'm afraid they won't. I think people will just simply say, keep out, it's not your vote, it's nothing to do with you, stop interfering. And they said this more or less the same, even for when Obama, who of all people is entitled to give his views, it was resented. And he said it very gently, or at least he made his point clear, but he said it very politely.
They don't just, that's the interesting thing, of course, is they don't just say to foreigners, which to some extent I find understandable. They say it to their own people. They say it to experts, to a really well-regarded independent institute like the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Suddenly, that is being dragged through the mud because they get some money from the European Union for some of their research. It's after 20 years in this country, I find it very, very disturbing. The country is like, seems to me, in a fever, in a state of in a spasm almost, where facts and reason and institutions don't count anymore. Where really third-rate parliamentarians attack the governor of the Bank of England in a way where you think, well, guys, you'll next Friday of next week, we'll have to carry on with these institutions together. You're destroying the basis of the institutions. Very, very dangerous.
Well, it is. It's more than that. I think all that is true, but I think there's also an undertone of nationalism, nationalist backlash, a sort of feeling of helplessness. And I have to say, this is not simply confined to this country. A lot of other countries have found high levels of disenchantment with Europe, with rising right-wing nationalism, with the sort of feeling that each country needs to take a better grip on its own future. And one of the problems for the European Union is if Britain goes, we may see similar movements in other countries.
Just finally, the campaigning has been getting more bizarre day by day. Just yesterday we saw UKIP leader Nigel Farage having a face-off with Bob Geldof on the River Thames. What do you expect from the following 7 days in terms of campaigning?
Well, let's see. I mean, of course, now this Labour MP Joe Cox has been murdered. The campaign has been suspended. I don't know. Will it resume tomorrow, or will there be another day of suspension? We shall see. I very much hope that a terrible deed like that might help to calm down the rhetoric slightly, because there is this whiff of, as Michael says, this whiff of very corrosive nationalism in the air, where people from groups like Historians for Britain, as if someone who wants to remain in the EU isn't patriotic enough. People need to pipe down slightly.
Let's move on to France next, where it was announced today that the far-right leader of the Russian Footballer Supporters Association is to be thrown out of the country following violence at the England-Russia Euro 2016 match in Marseille. Alexander Shprygin is among 20 Russian fans being deported. They were detained on Tuesday while travelling from Marseille to Lille to watch Russia take on Slovakia. In total, French police have made more than 300 arrests since the start of the European Championships. Michael, are we seeing the comeback of football hooliganism here?
We are indeed. I'm afraid I always thought you couldn't get football hooligans worse or more violent or more out of control than those who supported England. But I think the Russians are a pretty good match. In fact, almost worse. And at the moment, it does look as though the balance of violence is probably more on the Russian side than on the English side. But I'm afraid this is a virus that is spreading all over the place. And it's just a lot of disaffected, angry kind of people looking for a fight. And we've seen they came here in order, or came to the Euros to fight.
And why has it happened now?
Well, because the championships are going on, and also because France itself is in a somewhat disorganized and turbulent period in its own public affairs, and the police probably hadn't done much of the homework needed to spot these guys before they arrived. I think it's just an opportunity, and they seized it.
These fans, when they go to see these matches, they are representing their own countries. Sebastian, can you understand what's going on in their heads?
Can I just first of all say sorry? We've got tens of thousands of football fans from England who've travelled to France. We're talking about a tiny minority of possibly 2-3%. So let's first of all celebrate the 97-98% who go about their fandom in a totally peaceful manner. The first match was in Marseille. Now we've had hooliganism in Marseille during the World Cup in 1998. Marseille, as people may know, is a very difficult city, particularly the Old Harbour area, very difficult city to police. It really wasn't terribly difficult for the organisers to think about whether England versus Russia, which has a history of tension, shall we put it very mildly, whether that match should have been played in Marseille in the first place. And then, of course, there were two or three days where the police seemed to have running battles with English fans, and to be fair to the English fans, we all know that the French police is generally trigger happy, and they're of course still in a state of high alert after the terrorist attacks of last November. So we've got a very awkward mix here. But also, I think it's fair to say that while the English authorities are very clear about fighting hooliganism, the reaction from Russia has been from politicians in Russia, from elected parliamentarians in Russia, have been actually to encourage these thugs. And that's I think the very worrying sign that we're seeing.
Do you think we should think differently in the future when we are organizing this kind of sports events?
Well, they've asked that question many times over many years, and they've done quite a number of things. They've got police whose job is to identify, using intelligence methods, who are potential hooligans, to infiltrate some of these groups that exist simply in order to promote the kind of fighting we've seen. They've tightened up police methods, they've tightened up police control. It's not always been successful. I have to say, the last 20 years, the English fans haven't been as bad as they were before. And, as Sebastian says, we are talking only about a very small minority, but of course they are the ones who blacken the name of the entire country. I think more needs to be done, and we just need to go all over again back to looking at how we can do stuff better.
Sebastian, do you agree with that?
I think if Russian fans, we shouldn't call them fans, if Russian hooligans keep messing up France, Russia should not only be thrown out straight away, but also stripped of the right of organizing the World Cup. You've got to hit the countries which aren't in charge, but are encouraging their own hooligans. You've got to hit them hard.
Hosting an event such as Euro 2016 is an amazing opportunity to showcase what your country has and how great it is. Looking at what's happening in France, looking at the situation, what do you think? Does France want to gain something now that it's enjoying the world's attention, or is it now all about surviving and hoping that no more damage takes place?
Well, that's what I mean. I think that's what I mean. You know, you see lots of great pictures. You have fan fests all over the place. You get lots of Portuguese and Albanians and Icelanders, who of course are there for the first time ever, and Welsh for the first time since 1958. You know, they get together. They have football matches. There's lots of friendliness, and of course it's good for the friend. Tourism industry. So no, let these few pictures of thugs overshadow what is overall a peaceful and good event.
Yes, well, I'd agree with that, except that I don't think France is in a very peaceful and happy state itself at the moment, because we've had the most...
When is France ever?
unprecedented transport, public order strikes, public civil service strikes, and general discontent and a sort of political malaise that has overshadowed a lot of all this from the start.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24 with me, Marco Sipi, Michael Bini and Sebastian Borga. We take a short break now, and when we are back, we get the latest from our man in Orlando.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Just 18 minutes past the hour, you are listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24, and still with me are Michael Binion and Sebastian Borga. Now, all week we have been reporting live from Orlando and the aftermath of that terrible attack. Let's head to the city now for the latest with Monaco's Thomas Lewis. Thomas, welcome to the programme. I understand President Barack Obama has now arrived.
Yes, he has. Air Force One touched down probably about 20 minutes to half an hour ago now. His motorcade has just departed, heading into the city itself. It'll be a rather full and emotional day, is what we've heard from the White House press office. President Obama will be meeting people from across the spectrum affected by the attacks in the early hours of Sunday morning. So we believe the first port of call will be to meet medical staff at some of the hospitals, some of the nurses and the doctors who were there in the early hours of Sunday morning when the first casualties from the Pulse nightclub began to arrive. Then throughout the day, he'll be meeting with people who survived the attack and also meeting members of the families of those who died at the Pulse nightclub. We are expecting some remarks from President Obama a little later today. I think the people of Orlando will be, you know, watching watching with great interest to see what their president, what his reaction on both an emotional level and also in terms of the action he thinks might be appropriate now, kind of following the devastating events of the early hours of Sunday morning. So it does feel as though after a fairly bewildering week when people have been trying to get their heads around this terrible situation, that having President Obama here will both be a solace, I think, but also hopefully will offer some kind of path forward, I think, so that something like this on Orlando's doorstep will never happen again.
Thank you very much. That was Thomas Lewis in Orlando, and here in the studio I'm joined by Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion. Michael, how important is it that President Obama has now arrived in Orlando 4 days after the attack?
Well, I think it is important. I think it didn't matter that he didn't go down there straight away. That would have seemed really slightly an overreaction. There needs to be time to consider the implications and what happened. But now is the appropriate time for a more dignified ceremony of mourning led by the president and showing solidarity with those who were killed, their families and all the other people that we've heard about in the report.
Sebastian, do you think the events in Orlando will have long-standing consequences when you look at the political debate discussion taking place in America?
Well, let's hope. That's all we can do. I mean, it seems to me entirely unbelievable that this country still insists to let people who actually have been investigated by the FBI, who are clearly already connected to extremist groups of whatever persuasion, in this case Islamist, that they can go out by weapons and kill 49 people. The solution that there seem to me to be solutions. I mean, why are there, on average, much fewer attacks like that in very similar countries like Canada or indeed Western Europe? When we have, sadly, those attacks in those countries, at least the number of victims normally tends to be much lower.
Yeah, well, of course, the sales of submachine guns have gone up hugely in Orlando since the killings, which I'm afraid simply sends the wrong message.
This is a slightly confusing case. We don't really seem to know what the motive of terrorist Omar Mateen was. There's been reports of him actually visiting this club. There's much we don't really know about what's been going on in the background. How difficult does it make for everyone in America to move forward and find some kind of peace with this case?
Yes, it makes it difficult because everybody's looking for a cause and a way to blame people and a way to find some trigger reason for all this. And at first, it looked like a straight terrorist incident. And that, of course, was a huge fillip to Donald Trump, who repeated his, I think, disgraceful remarks about not allowing Muslims into America. But then other things came out, and as you say, whether this person was conflicted in his own sexuality and whether this was his own response to what he felt were unacceptable feelings that he himself had and was going suffering from some kind of revenge motive, we don't know. But that, of course, turns around the whole debate, because partly it was seen that LGBT groups were victims, and now it seems, well, not necessarily victims. It just happened to be they were caught up in the middle of all this.
But isn't it also, I mean, as far as I understand it, he's been visiting. Doesn't mean that he went to the nightclub as a gay person or as someone who thinks about his sexuality. It could also just be reconnaissance, couldn't it?
It could be, but others say he was here and trying to pick people up in the clubs. So the witnesses...
Are they? Right.
Oh,
okay.
People have said that, yes.
I see.
Okay.
Well, let's continue now with NATO and how that military alliance is preparing for new challenges and warfare. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has said in an interview published by Germany's Bild newspaper that a major cyber attack could trigger a collective response by NATO. What the response would be like, well, that would depend on the severity of the attack. He spoke after a decision this week by NATO ministers to designate cyber as an official operational domain of warfare, along with air, sea and land. Michael, does this come a bit late?
Of course it does. It's a ridiculous thing to suddenly say, now we find that there's a new domain of warfare. You know, it's as though somebody's just invented the aeroplane, so we're now going to have an air force or something like that. We've just discovered that cyber is an area open to attack and is extremely vulnerable and very important to our countries and our defence. Well, they've actually been responding to cyber attacks for some time. The problem has been to determine whether this is a state-sponsored attack or whether it is individuals hacking and trying to cause mayhem. There have been cases, more and more cases, of whole countries masterminding cyber attacks that have been very damaging, and China is one that a finger has been pointed at, and various others. And I think they're now saying, we will respond in kind. And I expect that there are contingency plans for cyber warfare going the other way. We've seen it, after all, by both America and Israel in the case of Iranian nuclear scientists who were victims of cyber attacks in Iran.
Sebastian, how significant do you think this statement is?
I, to be honest, think that Mr. Stoltenberg is trying to inject some razzmatazz into his organization. And isn't there a summit coming up where maybe he needs some publicity? It seems fairly old hat. Yes. I mean, the Americans, I think, have said 5 years ago that they would, and quite rightly, obviously, I think, if attacked, they would retaliate in the same way. And also, let's be in no doubt, they've been developing offensive capacities in that area themselves as well. As Michael has pointed out, Israel has as well. So yeah, it's good publicity for NATO, which is never a bad thing.
Well, we have a few minutes left today, and let's finish by talking about Brexit again. One interesting angle is the role that newspapers play in that debate. The Sun, a paper here in the UK, has come out in favour of leaving the European Union, and meanwhile the Financial Times has just said it's for remaining. But do these kind of announcements or endorsements actually have an impact on voter behaviour? Michael, what are your thoughts?
I don't think the solemn pronouncements of leaders, editorial opinion, really influences people much, indeed. What matters are the headlines day by day. It's the actual news reports. And if you have a screaming headline saying, save our country, leave, or something like that, a tabloid headline, that is much more influential than a comment by, say, The Sun. Or the Financial Times is utterly predictable that they would come out the way they have come out. And I don't think readers of Financial Times themselves are going to be swayed one way or the other. Very few who want to leave who are going to say, oh my goodness, I've read the comment in the FT, I better change my mind.
It's. I think that is the point, that so far the declarations have been totally predictable. I think the only and as a foreigner looking at the main media in Britain, it is striking how many are for leave. How many of the newspapers? Of course, a lot of them owned by not least the Times and the Sun, owned by a foreign publisher.
I think you'll find that Times and the Sun are taking opposite lines when it comes to.
We're waiting with. I thought we were still waiting with bated breath to the Times, because the Times, in my view, has been the only one, which has really done quite fair reporting.
How do you think? How united is the editorial staff when it comes to these kind of statements? Do papers come out in favour of one of the camps just because they expect that their readers want to hear that?
That's been the tradition. It's not a tradition in other countries. I don't mean in a referendum, because we've hardly ever had one, but in general elections, for example, papers always think that it is their duty to say, this is where we stand and this is what we think. Now, some countries, the papers would never do that. They would think that would be a complete
dereliction of duty.
Yeah, indeed. But in this country, that is a tradition, and so papers are expected to say where do they stand, and they do say it.
And looking at, for example, this example of The Sun that earlier this week came out indeed very massively in favour of Brexit, do you think the staff are united? Do you think they actually feel that way, or did they do that because they think that their readers just expect that from the paper?
Well, I think with The Sun, they know their readers overwhelmingly will agree with that sentiment. They also know that their proprietor will probably agree with that sentiment. And that is the dilemma for The Times, because overwhelmingly their readers will favour Remain. But we're not quite sure whether that is what the proprietor thinks.
Michael Binion and Sebastian Borga, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House, as this is all we have time for on today's programme. Today's show was produced by Daniel Ciccapelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alice Tennant, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. We have The Atlantic Shift next, that is music from around the world. Then in about 30 minutes at 1900 London time, 1400 in New York, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. This programme, Midori House, is back at the same time tomorrow, that is at 1800 London time. I am Markus Hippi, thank you for listening and goodbye.